from 89.3 KPCC. This is Take Two. I'm E. Martinez. So how would you feel about paying a tax on all those texts you send every day? Well, it's an idea that the California Public Utilities Commission has floated out there. But does it even have the authority? We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. First, though, another controversial plan. The State Water Board voted on a plan Wednesday afternoon to redistribute water from communities in the Central Valley to Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta waterways. The Department of Water Resources said it would move some 700,000 acre-feet of water to the area to help salmon and other fish species that have been struggling with limited water flow. This follows an almost decade-long debate about where the water should go. Many of you have probably seen signs about this up and down the 5 freeway, but the issue isn't likely to end here. Area farmers are calling yesterday's plan a water grab. For more, we're joined by Sacramento Bee reporter Ryan Saplow. Ryan, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, this whole fight has been going on for a long time, but before we get into the particulars of this current plan, let's talk about the waterways in question. Why is the San Joaquin so important, and what communities rely on it?
All right, so the San Joaquin River flows from north to south, from south to north, and it goes up through places like Modesto and goes out through the Delta, meets up with the Sacramento River, and goes out through the Golden Gate Bridge. All right, so that kind of orientates folks. And you have three tributaries on the San Joaquin River, the Merced, Stanislaus, and the Tuolumne, that all flow into it. And over time, the farms and cities, including the city of San Francisco and Modesto, have taken a substantial amount of water out of those rivers. We're talking about 80% of the river's normal flows get diverted to farms and cities some years. And so as a result of that, the Water Board is saying that there's just not enough water to sustain these endangered fish species. And so this plan yesterday, they say, will provide about, you know, it doubles the amount of water in the river during some years, and that provides, will provide enough water for the fish to get going. And, of course, the farms and the cities say, this is a really, really big hit to the amount of water that we have for people, for the needs of people.
And considering how much food California produces for the rest of the country, too. But, Ryan, is this debate that simple, fish versus farms?
No, not at all. I mean, on the Tuolumne River in particular, San Francisco gets a substantial, I think it's like 90% of their water supply comes from a dam up in Yosemite National Park that diverts water out of the Tuolumne.
Now, the Water Board believes that the salmon and steelhead fish in those rivers need the help, right? They're saying that this absolutely has to happen for these fish to survive.
That's what they're saying, yeah.
Now, the Water Board went ahead and voted to redistribute this water, but the board itself said it was open to a broader agreement that would include area cities and farms that have a stake in this. Can you explain exactly what that means?
Yeah, so basically, the Water Board did not necessarily want to impose these restrictions unilaterally. They have been saying for years that, hey, we want all the parties on these rivers, the San Joaquin River and its tributaries, to come together and come up with some sort of broad agreement that improves habitat, and increases flows on the rivers. And, you know, nothing in water in California ever happens quickly.
And so, yeah,
they were poised last month to vote on this, and Governor Brown and incoming Governor Gavin Newsom urged the board to wait a month and let these parties come to the table. And they had said, we hope that we can come up with some agreement on the San Joaquin. And what it ended up happening is they were able to come up with a very tentative agreement on the Tuolumne yesterday that they presented to the board. But the other two rivers, the Stanislaus and the Merced, weren't able to come up with theirs. Meanwhile, on the other river system, the Sacramento River system, they have a much more kind of fleshed out settlement agreement, but that wasn't under discussion yesterday.
So it sounds like this is not over. What happened yesterday doesn't mean anything's decided yet.
No, absolutely not. The Water Board has explicitly said, they wrote language in the measure yesterday that we want to revisit this with the idea that we can come together and come up with some sort of voluntary agreement that can do this. But the board was very clear. We want to make sure that they said that we want to make sure that we have this sort of, for lack of a better word, regulatory gun, you know, pointed at you, yeah, so that we can put pressure on you to actually come to the table and get these jobs done.
It almost sounds, Ryan, like no solution would satisfy everyone completely. Is that what we're going to have to live with, I think?
Yeah, I mean, and the proposed settlements on both the Sacramento and the Tuolumne yesterday, the environmentalists were had dozens of environmentalists came up and fishing groups and tribal members came up and said that this was basically window dressing. It didn't address the problems. The amount of flows that the farms and cities were proposing to leave in the river weren't nearly enough, according to the environmentalists and those groups. And so that was one of the other reasons why the board moved ahead, saying, and the board chairwoman yesterday said, you know, you need to make sure that the environmentalists have the buy-in that they're asking for on these before we sign off.
Is this one of those things, Ryan, where if California weren't in a drought and say we had plenty of rain and plenty of water flowing, that this wouldn't be as much of an issue? Or is this just because it's water, it's our most fought over resource in California, it's going to be a fight no matter what?
Well, I mean, I think everybody's acknowledging more or less that, everybody more or less is acknowledging, because I think there's a growing consensus out there, even among some of the farming districts, is that with climate change, and they're looking at snowpack models, and, you know, California's largest reservoir is the Sierra. That's what holds our snow. And if you look at some of the studies coming out showing that the snowpack is on a precipitous decline, you know, over time. And that's going to mean that everybody's going to have to make do with less here. And I think that that's going to be a major part of these discussions moving forward.
So it sounds like people are fighting for future water, future dwindling water.
Right, right. And meanwhile, the fish, you know, there are folks who are saying if we don't do this, these native fish species that rely on clean, cold, clear, fast-moving water and habitat, you know, we've turned our rivers into kind of drainage ditches over the years, that they're going to go extinct if we don't do something.
All right, now we mentioned how this isn't settled yet. So what are you going to be watching for next on this?
I'm going to be watching to see whether the action the board took yesterday really does kind of force people to the table and get people thinking seriously about how are we going to come together and try to make this work. I'm going to be watching to see if the environmentalists, if these parties do come to the table on the lower San Joaquin and are able to hash out an agreement, whether the environmentalists are supportive of it. Because they're very concerned that the amount of water that the farms and cities are proposing to leave in the river isn't nearly enough for the fish, and that a lot of the habitat projects that they're talking about doing, they say, aren't adequate enough to, you know, get the fish back in some sort of semblance of health.
Sacramento Bee reporter Ryan Sabalo about the latest in the battle over water in the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta. Ryan, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. In case you don't follow President Trump's tweets, he was online this morning responding to yesterday's sentencing of his former lawyer, Michael Cohen. He tweeted, quote, "I never directed Michael Cohen to break the law. He was a lawyer and is supposed to know the law. It's called advice of counsel, and a lawyer has great liability if a mistake is made." Now, Cohen was sentenced to 3 years in prison for crimes that include making payments to silence women who claim they had affairs with Trump. That's fair to say that the president likes to tweet and throw a little shade on California. So if he lived here and texted as much as he tweets, he might have even more reason to come after the Golden State. And that's because the California Public Utilities Commission is mulling over the unthinkable, taxing your texts. In a report released last month, the commission made the case for adding a surcharge to Californians' text. The tax money would help support programs that make phone service accessible to low-income residents. Ed McCaffrey is a tax law professor at USC's Gould School of Law. He's on the line now to tell us about how this might be a sign of things to come. Ed, welcome to Take Two.
Nice to be here, eh? Nice to be talking with you.
All right. Tell us more about this potential tax. How would it work?
Yeah, so it's a very interesting thing, because what California has really across its utilities, so this would include mobile phone service, landlines. It's also these kinds of surcharges are on your water bills, your electrical bills. They're called PPP, or public purpose program surcharges. So they're surcharges on these kind of regulated activities to get money to help low-income people and the elderly and people who need assistance in getting such services. Right now, there's a surcharge in place, and there has been for many years, on mobile phone calls, on cell phone calls.
Yeah.
But one of the things is we all know, you know, what we learned to do, our kids have stopped doing already. So people are making fewer phone calls.
Yeah.
People are not doing the voicemail thing. Instead, they're texting. And what California wants to do is extend the surcharge that they already have on cell phones to texting. And they're going to use that money, if they get it, if they get this proposal through, they're going to use that money to help to continue to provide benefits for low-income telecommunications users.
And one of the things that people have been saying, or at least people have been asking, is would each text cost a fixed amount? I mean, I can't imagine it'd be a penny, so maybe a fraction of a penny, but is that how it would work? Each text, the second you hit send, you know that you are paying for that.
Right. So in the sense that it would be a very small surcharge.
Okay.
So I think we are talking, you know, pennies or a dollar or so a month. No, in the sense that we don't have a lot of details coming out of the California Public Utilities Commission about what they're thinking. We know how much money they think they're going to raise. They think they're going to get $44 million a year. They're talking about making this retroactive for 5 years. But it seems as if the charge would be a flat charge. It wouldn't be per text. But if your carrier sort of allocated, you know, charged $10 a month to have text and data services, it would be on that flat amount. It wouldn't vary with the per text. It would end up being a kind of fixed amount per month for people who use text on their phones.
What's the wireless communications industry saying about this?
Yeah, so they're not happy about it. And it's very interesting. And now we're getting into a turf war with the federal government, because the FCC came out yesterday and said that text messages are a quote-unquote information service. Now, that's buzzwords for internet-based. So the internet-based messaging apps that, again, my kids are way ahead of me on this, but if you use iMessage, if you use WhatsApp, that won't be covered. Those don't go through the phone lines.
Oh.
So the telecommunications industry is saying, wait a minute, we don't like taxes, period, anyway. And in addition, this is going to put us at a competitive disadvantage because there's another way to communicate. Forget the voicemail, forget the phone text, get the app. So this is a moving target with various aspects of the industry getting caught in a trap, but other aspects of the industry looking like they're going to get a competitive advantage.
We're talking to Ed McCaffrey, tax law professor at USC's Gould School of Law. All right, let's broaden this out, Ed. Why do you think this could be a sign of things to come?
Yeah, because now we go back to, I really like your lead-in. You're tying it all at the thumbs of the president, at the tweets of Trump. So if we go back to the Republican tax cut, the 2017 act that voters kind of rebelled against here in California and across the country in the recent midterms, that act put pressure on states such as California, blue states, that rely on progressive taxes like state income taxes. So the federal law now limits the amount of federal deduction you can get for state and local taxes. That's going to hurt California. And in particular, it's going to hurt the California approach to taxation, which is an attempt to get the wealthy Californians to pay more to help out the lower income. So here we see a kind of small, sneaky, somewhat hidden until reporters like you have jumped on it, tax that's really going to apply to everybody. You get a few pennies, a few dollars from virtually every Californian every month. Well, that starts adding up to millions. I think that's the kind of thing in an era in which you just the income tax is limited in part because of federal policy. We're going to see sneaky little taxes on gas, on cell phones, on the provision of social services.
But Ed, let me ask you this. You're a tax law professor based in California, so you live here, so you're taxed right. Just like the rest of us. We get taxed a lot in California. You think we'll feel this?
Oh, sure. I mean, whether or not we will feel, I mean, this is sort of the death by a thousand cuts. Whether or not, you know, you or I in particular are going to feel, you know, another $5 a year on our cell phone bills, whether we're going to see that. But it's not just that. In for a penny, in for a pound. I think there are going to be lots of little penny type taxes throughout California. And at some point, you know, $5 here, $5 there, it starts adding up to, you know, we're not going out to eat as much. We're not seeing as many movies. We're not buying as many Christmas presents for our children.
Ed McCaffrey is a tax law professor at USC's Gould School of Law. Ed, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you, Ed, very much.
All right, losses from California's wildfires approaching $10 billion. We're getting close, and that might not be where it ends. Coming up next, we're going to figure out exactly what happens to insurance companies that might have to cover those losses and if it's even worth it to rebuild in those high-risk fire areas. We're going to talk to California Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Insurance claims from last month's wildfires are currently $9 billion and are expected to increase. Most of those claims are from the Camp Fire up north, about $7 billion, but the rest come from the Woolsey and Hill fires that have burned through Malibu and the Thousand Oaks areas. The devastation from wildfires in the last year alone is startling. Five of the top 10 most destructive fires in the state happened in the last 15 months, according to Cal Fire. And that left us wondering how much longer insurance coverage will be available in fire-prone areas. Now, for more on this, we reached out to California Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones. Nice to talk to you again.
Good to be with you.
All right, $9 billion. Dave, can you put that in context for us relative to claims we've seen in the past?
These were the deadliest and most destructive fires as measured by lives lost, at least 88 lives lost, and by acreage burned. In terms of the claims numbers, fires in 2018 in November have not yet exceeded the insured losses associated with the Northern and Southern California fires in October and December of 2017 taken as a whole, but it's very close. Some of the reason for that difference has to do with the difference in the average median price of homes in Butte County, where the Camp Fire was so devastating, versus the average median price of homes in Sonoma County, which was ravaged by the 2017 fires. But these are preliminary numbers. They're not estimates. They're hard numbers based on data we've collected from the insurers, based on the claims that fire survivors have filed. We anticipate the $9 billion number will increase as claims are amended.
When do you think we'll get the full picture of losses from last month's fires?
It'll be some matter of months. We know that the insurance recovery process is a very long and painful one for communities and for people. People are only now just getting back into the burn areas of the Camp Fire to fully assess their loss. They'll be talking to their insurer, amending, no doubt, their claims. There's a lot of back and forth that goes on. And so it'll be a number of months.
As I mentioned, some of the most destructive fires in California burned in the last 15 months, starting with the Wine Country fires last year. Dave, can you recall for us now what the total losses have been in terms of insurance claims?
For 2018, we're roughly at about $9.8 billion total versus about $12.6 billion in insured losses for 2017.
We're talking to California Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones. A couple of weeks ago, the small insurer up north, a Merced Property and Casualty Company, went out of business and the state had to take it over. A rare incident. But Dave, is there any concern with the mounting losses from so many mega wildfires and a future that's expected to bring more of them, that small companies like Merced Property and Casualty Company could meet the same fate?
We did move aggressively to take over Merced, a very small insurance company that simply was overwhelmed by the number of claims associated with the Camp Fire, which of course is the deadliest and most destructive fire in California's history. We took over that company and then turned over the claims handling process to the California Insurance Guarantee Association, which is established by statute to handle claims payment for insolvent insurance companies. We have contacted all the California insurers that write homeowners and fire insurance to ascertain their current financial situation. We've received no reports that any company is facing the same sort of dire financial circumstances that led us to take over Merced. We are, however, steadily marching towards a future in which large parts of California may be uninsurable. And we're not doing enough in the United States and across the globe to fight climate change. We're not doing enough in the United States. In fact, President Trump has reversed efforts to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. California is going to be faced with hotter, drier conditions, droughts, and that's going to contribute to more frequent and severe wildfires. And that means insurance companies are declining to renew insurance policies for homes in these areas, the wildland urban interface areas, or they're declining to write new insurance.
Let's talk about the next phase for a lot of people, and that's rebuilding. Already officials up in Paradise, the town that was leveled by the Camp Fire, are talking about rebuildings. Dave, should we be rebuilding in high-risk fire areas?
It's a natural and common reaction when you've lost everything to want to rebuild and get back to normal. The problem is that we know that these areas will be even more risky over time because of what's happening with regard to rising temperatures. So there are a lot of things that need to be done. Last session, the legislature and governor acted to appropriate substantial dollars to begin to clear more brush, more fuel from forests, to begin doing more burns to try to get rid of some of that fuel. And I think, too, we've got to give a lot more thought to how we make decisions in the first instance to put people into harm's way. We increasingly are putting people and businesses into floodplains, into coastal areas where we know the sea is going to rise, and into high-risk fire areas. And how we make those decisions needs to be changed. Right now, those decisions are made at the local level, and the future costs of those decisions aren't adequately incorporated into the decision to make sure we're getting good decisions.
But wouldn't the safest thing to do, Dave, is just to simply not build in these high-risk areas?
That's certainly what retiring Fire Chief Ken Pimlott of the Cal Fire Agency suggested just the other day. I think that's a real challenge in communities that want to rebuild and want to get back on their feet. But that's exactly the sort of conversation we're going to have in the legislature and across California.
Does it make sense?
I think that's exactly the question that we're going to have to grapple with.
Dave, you'll be leaving your post soon. Ricardo Lara will be taking over as insurance commissioner, but you've been in charge at a time when the state has experienced a lot of calamity over the last few years. What do you think will be the biggest challenge for Ricardo Lara when he comes into office?
It's the understanding of the nature of the risk in the wildland urban interface areas, understanding the nature of the risk of sea level rise and of floods and floodplains, and the impact of those rising risks associated with climate change that on the availability and pricing of insurance.
Outgoing California Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones. Dave, thanks a lot.
Thanks so very much.
Between 2013 and 2016, caseworkers for the LA County Department of Children and Family Services responded to a dozen complaints about 10-year-old Anthony Avalos of Lancaster. His mother and her boyfriend have been charged with torturing and murdering him. Last week, grand jury documents were unsealed in the case, including phone calls such as this one between a DCFS worker reporting bruises on the face and arms of one of Anthony's siblings and an abuse hotline employee.
So are you alleging more neglect or alleging more physical abuse by an unknown perpetrator? Or
no.
What's our allegation, would you say? I know we have to put
something. To cover our butt?
I know. To cover. I know. This is pitiful, I know.
Anthony Avalos died this past June, but the last complaint involving him was April 2016. By then, DCFS had stopped monitoring the family. Bobby Cagle is a director of the Los Angeles County Department of Children and Family Services, or DCFS. Bobby, welcome back to Take Two.
Thank you very much.
Now, I know you did not take over the department until late last year, but what can you tell us about this particular exchange we just heard? Do we know when it took place? Was it one of the first few complaints about abuse in the Avalos household, or was it closer maybe to April of 2016?
I'm not exactly sure about that time frame, but it was, I think, one of the earlier calls, and as you alluded to, it was about a sibling in the household.
What's important, Bobby, to know about the context of that call and the conversation we just heard?
When I first saw the reports on television, I was extremely concerned and really wanted to better understand exactly what was going on. So I listened to the whole tape. And this is about a 15-minute interview at the hotline with a worker in the field. Let me say from the outset that child abuse and neglect is no laughing matter in my estimation. So the laughter that was heard, I firmly consider to be inappropriate, as well as the language around covering your butt. That is not the kind of approach that I want my staff taking to these cases. They need to be dealing with them with utmost seriousness, as well as an understanding of exactly why we do the things that we do, especially determining what kind of report it is.
When you arrived at DCFS, you were probably well aware that you were taking over a department that had problems with the reporting process. What does that exchange, though, tell you about the culture of the agency at that time?
You know, it's very interesting because although the remarks that you played are concerning, if you listen to the context of the entire report, what you hear is a worker who is advocating strenuously for the case to be dealt with in a more expeditious manner and at a higher level of service. She's asking for a physical abuse and an immediate response. When you hear the laughter, you hear the remark, you think that they're really not dealing with it with great seriousness, when in fact they are. What I have to do is really work on the culture in the organization. And I believe two things are going on here. First and foremost is you have workers who are dealing with tremendous amounts of stress, seeing children mistreated in ways that are unimaginable every day. You also have a great deal of bureaucracy, as with any government organization, and that brings frustration for staff. And so looking at it from the perspective of the staff person, I have really asked them to consider what was going on there and why that occurred. I think that some of that was nervous laughter. The cover your butt remark, I think, is an allusion to the fact that we have very prescribed ways of taking those reports, and the bureaucracy sometimes is very difficult for staff. Nonetheless, those remarks and the laughter, in my estimation, is inappropriate, and we're dealing with that as we need to.
Talking to Bobby Cagle, director of the Los Angeles County Department of Children and Family Services. Last week, after these grand jury transcripts and recordings came to light, you announced that you're launching an investigation. Has that investigation started?
Actually, we have started and concluded it, although I can't talk to you about the specifics of what we do with employees because of state and federal laws around that. I can tell you that I dealt with this with the utmost seriousness to the extent that I sat down and listened a number of times to the call myself to better get an understanding of exactly what was going on.
Would you be able to share the conclusions with the family of Anthony Avalos, or is that something that's still down the road?
That is still down the road. I think, as you're aware, that is still a criminal prosecution in process. So we always avoid talking about those cases to assure that we're not in some way impeding the prosecution. I think that would be a tragic outcome in and of itself. I deal with it with seriousness, and I apologize. I do not in any way condone it, but I also have to do this in a measured way because this is in some ways a very concerning matter, but it is a point in time and not necessarily indicative of the kind of work that these employees do on a daily basis from what we can tell by looking at their records.
Bobby, you're coming up on a year here in Los Angeles. How much has dealing with the Anthony Avalos case aftermath affected your ability to really evaluate DCFS? As you told us you would when we spoke first about a year ago.
I would not say that it's in any way interfered with it. Actually, I think in a very tragic way, it has given us points of focus that allowed us to more deeply look at our system. We had concerns that arose out of this case with voluntary family maintenance program. We are working to change policy around that to assure that it is best used. We saw that there are weaknesses in interviewing and investigating, also in recognizing injuries and dealing with those appropriately. And so we're instituting training as a result of that. We are really all heartbroken about this. If you're a child welfare worker, and I've dedicated my life to this as well as being a social worker and as a former foster child, this really hits hard. And so what we try to do in each and every case of this type is to learn from it, to give ourselves an opportunity to better deal with the kind of problems that big systems like LA County deal with on a daily basis.
Bobby Cagle is the director of the LA County Department of Children and Family Services. Bobby, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Now, I think we all know that the wheels on the bus go round, 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 and the wipers on the bus go swish, swish, swish. The horn goes beep, beep, beep. I know, I'll stop. The big question in California going forward, though, is what sound will the engine on the bus make? It might not be vroom, vroom, vroom. Coming up, find out what that new bus sound will sound like. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. It's been said the future is electric, and a lot of news out of California this week indicates that will definitely be the case. The state is the nation's front runner in electric vehicle sales of all kinds, from cars to transit buses. And that is the subject of The Ride, our weekly look at personal mobility. Motor critic Sue Carpenter joins us now, as she does each and every Thursday. Hello, Sue.
Hey.
All right, let's start with the California Air Resources Board, which will be voting tomorrow to make all transit buses in the state zero emissions by 2040. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it is called the Innovative Clean Transit Measure, and I would say that unless war breaks out or there is some other disaster, the Air Resources Board is certain to pass this thing. This mandate has been in the works for almost a decade, since before electric buses were even commercially available. It wasn't until 2015 that buses that run on batteries came on the market in any significant way. Yesterday, I spoke with the ARB's Tony Brazil. He runs the agency's Clean Transportation Technology Branch, which is proposing this new rule, and here is what he had to say.
Yeah, we've been working at this for some time to find a way to move forward that works for our air quality goals, but also works for the transit agencies.
All right, so how will this work for transit agencies?
Well, they're going to need to fully transition their bus fleets to zero emissions by 2040. Of the state's 200 or so transit agencies, 17 of them have already committed to switching to zero emissions, including the largest transit agency in the state, which is right here in LA, LA Metro, and also the LA Department of Transportation. But in a little more than 20 years, every single transit agency in the state is going to have to do it.
Every single one. So how many buses does that affect?
Not as many as you might think. Huh. There are about 14,000 transit buses in California. Right now, only 150 of them are electric and already on the road. Orders have been placed for about 1,000 more, so there's still a long way to go for transit agencies to switch over to zero emissions.
Okay, why transit buses, though? How much can electric versions of transit buses help with emissions reductions and improved air quality?
Well, they can help a lot because 14,000 buses, as I said, does not sound like that much compared with the 25 million cars that are driving around here in the state. But switching transit buses from diesel or natural gas to either battery electric or fuel cell electric models, that has a multiplier effect, because the average transit bus travels about 40,000 miles per year. That's 3 to 4 times more than the average car. And each one of those buses also consumes about 4 times as much fuel per mile as a car. So replacing a diesel bus with an electric bus has a much bigger impact on emissions and fuel consumption than doing the same thing with passenger vehicles, which is why the state is doing it. And as you know, California has very aggressive emissions reductions targets. It also has some of the worst air quality in the country. So cleaning up transit buses will help improve not only the environment, but also public health and quality of life, because electric buses, they will be quiet.
That's, you know, funny. Yesterday, I was doing a field interview in Boyle Heights, and we were right off the street. So I was doing an interview, and we had to pause every minute or so because a bus would come by and completely ruin things.
They are loud.
So, yeah, noise pollution definitely is a plus here. Now, would it cost more for agencies to buy these zero-emission buses?
Yeah. So an average diesel-powered transit bus is $500,000,
Ooh,
which
wow.
I think is shocking just as a pure
Get
number.
A Ferrari for that kind of money.
Yeah, or a couple.
A fleet of
yeah.
Ferraris all over.
So if you make that same bus run on natural gas, you're adding $50,000 to the price tag. A battery electric bus costs $250,000 more.
Oof, wow.
And if it's hydrogen fuel cell, the total cost is more than $1 million per bus. So it's definitely going to cost transit agencies a lot more to switch over until there are economies of scale that bring those prices down.
Does the state have a plan to help transit agencies pay for this forced transition to electric buses?
They do. There's also federal money on the table. But in terms of the state, California has several different incentives offered through cap and trade. There are multiple agencies that can take hundreds of thousands of dollars off the upfront purchase price and make them comparable to models powered with fossil fuels just in terms of the upfront cost. Here is the ARB's Tony Brazil explaining the savings in operation costs.
Rule of thumb number is about 25% lower cost of operating for maintenance purposes.
So that is maintenance, things like brakes. But in terms of fuel, that would be electricity. It depends when and where a bus recharges. But Brazil said that in many cases, there are credits that make the electricity free.
All right. Now, when do these new rules kick in on a practical level for transit agencies?
So the transit agencies are not required to start switching over until 2023. That's when the ARB says that at least 25% of their new bus purchases need to be zero emissions. But any zero emissions buses purchased before then would count toward that requirement. So if enough transit agencies buy these buses in advance, the requirement might not actually take effect until 2025.
2025. All right. Now, since we're talking about electrics, let's also get into cars.
California,
yeah, why not? I mean, buses,
yeah.
Cars, trains, planes. No, that's a different movie. California hit a very important milestone this week when it comes to electric passenger vehicle sales. What's the latest there, Sue?
California announced that it had sold its 500,000th electric car last month. It's actually sold more than 512,000 of them total. So EV sales in the state, they're up 30% from last month. They are up 164% from a year ago. I know this is a lot of numbers, but they are now 7% of car sales in the state, and the state itself makes up almost half of all the EV sales nationally. So California is on track to sell 5 million EVs in the next 12 years, and that is a lot. But state officials say that turnover still isn't fast enough to combat climate change and air pollution, because we've got more people moving to the state, and they're driving more miles per year, and that's generating more emissions.
What's driving the increase in EV sales?
Well, part of it is Tesla. Model 3. As you know, I have this car.
And I got a story to tell you about that in a second.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I do want to hear it. So with the company cranking out at least 5,000 of these things every week and prioritizing California deliveries, that's part of what's driving the increase. But there's also more awareness of electric cars just generally. There are more options when it comes to electric cars. There are 43 different models with at least partial electrification available in California. And by 2025, there are expected to be more than 250 electric vehicles capable of more than 200 miles per charge.
Such as what kind of cars?
Oh, well, you and I, we were walking around the auto show a couple weeks ago.
I remember, yeah.
So everybody knows the Nissan Leaf, the Chevy Bolt, Hyundai Ioniq, Toyota Mirai, Honda Clarity. Coming up next year, there's going to be the electric versions of the Kia Niro and the Soul. And going more upscale, there's the Audi e-tron. And then the Jaguar I-Pace, Jaguar's first fully electric vehicle, which is only the second battery electric SUV to come on the market after the Tesla Model X. What I think is cool is that anybody who's interested in that car, Jaguar is doing something right now in Los Angeles. It's called the Electrified Experience Tour, and it is running through Sunday, today through Sunday at Santa Monica's Burger Hangar. So if you want to put an EV through its paces on a coned course, that's your opportunity.
Now, you mentioned how the Tesla Model 3 is accounting for all these sales.
Mm-hmm.
Burbank Town Center Mall has a lot more parking than business traffic in the mall. At least they're trying to spruce it up. But One of the parking structures is just loaded with Teslas, loaded with brand new Teslas. They're storing them there. It has to be because there's a Tesla dealership in Glendale on San Fernando Road down the street.
It's the same thing with
it's
the Americana.
Loaded.
Yeah.
And the old IKEA in Burbank.
Yeah.
That parking lot full of Tesla 3s.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's where they're at. If you want one, go look over there. That's Motor Critic Sue Carpenter bringing us all the latest news about electric vehicles. You can catch her here with us every single Thursday for our personal mobility segment, The Ride. Sue, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
New York Senator Chuck Schumer has a lot on his plate. He's the Senate Minority Leader. He's going to try to work with the president to avoid a government shutdown. Understandable if he's not up on the latest in comedy or fashion. Coming up, find out how Chuck Schumer's cousin is fusing those two worlds together. That's ahead when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Today is the official launch of Le Cloud, a new clothing collection designed by costume designer and celebrity stylist Lisa Evans in partnership with comedian Amy Schumer. That's right, Senator Chuck Schumer's cousin. And it's getting a lot of buzz, not only because of who's involved with it, but also because it's being billed as a size-inclusive clothing line. For more, we have Michelle Dalton-Tyree with Fashion Trends Daily. Michelle, welcome back.
Hi.
All right, size inclusive. What exactly is size inclusive?
So I know this sounds like a very politically correct fashion term, but it simply means that the line offers sizes at both ends of the spectrum and everything between. So it's a newer term in the apparel industry that we're starting to see more of from brands. When Khloe Kardashian actually launched her Good American Denim brand a few years ago, it too offered a range of styles and was considered size inclusive. And in the case of Le Cloud, this new collection by Lisa Evans and Amy Schumer, the line will offer everything from a size 0 to 20, which is extra small, to XXL.
The genius thing about Khloe Kardashian's size collection is that you were either a Khloe, a Kourtney, or a Kim in jeans. And that's how they sized them. Yeah.
And who are you?
I'm maybe the brother. All right, so what kind of clothes are in this new collection, Le Cloud? Since Evans is a celebrity stylist and costume designer, wondering, is it red carpet ready?
It's actually just the opposite. It's really all about comfort meets style, which has been the essence of the working relationship between Evans and Schumer. They've put together everything from these comfortable knit maxi dresses, which Schumer has been wearing a lot of since she is actually pregnant with her first child.
Oh, wow.
Two jumpsuits, a puffer jacket that Evans has actually been wearing a lot of.
Now, it's such an interesting pairing. How did this partnership come about and lead to a clothing line?
Well, Evans is a costume designer as well as a stylist and has done costumes for films such as Bridesmaids, Neighbors, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and Trainwreck, which Amy starred in.
Yeah, that was her movie.
Yeah, and where the two met. When I spoke with Evans on the phone this week, she said that when the duo works together on projects and tours, Amy is always semi-jokingly, but yet really not, wanting to wear sweats for stand-up and press junkets. And Evans is always, you know, trying to elevate her look. So this collection is the melding of both sensibilities, or really that hilarious push-pull between the two. I mean, you could almost see the skit there, you know, happening with Evans really wanting to get the sweatpants off of her.
Schumer talks about in her stand-up comedy wanting to be as comfortable as possible in every situation. She always talks about that.
I love that.
So how
actually
did they come up with the name, though, Le Cloud?
It's actually a really funny story. Here's Lisa Evans.
Amy, as we would get ready for press tours for different films, she would say, "Does that feel like a cloud? Because if it doesn't, I'm not going to wear it." And I was like, "Come on, Amy, not everything feels like a cloud. You know, there's certain things we need to put on and look appropriate for promoting this film." So for the last press tour for I Feel Pretty, I ended up making so many of the things that she wore during that press tour. I probably made 90% of the clothes. And we realized that it was possible that we could do that.
Making clothes for press tours is absolutely no small thing because, as Evans told me, there can be up to 50 different events and you can't be photographed wearing the same thing.
I mean, you could if you didn't care, right? I mean,
that's right. Yeah. But, you know, celebs would normally not be caught dead wearing the same outfit twice. So basically, with 50 different events where you need a new outfit, it was then that they decided to make stylish clothes that feel like you're wearing, well, a cloud. And hence, Le Cloud was born.
Le Cloud. Now, okay, so what's the price point of this new collection, and where can people find it?
Well, the duo was very, very specific from the get-go to make sure that it was accessible. The line is actually priced from, are you ready? $38 to $248.
Ooh, wow. Okay.
And right now, it's an exclusive partnership with Saks Off Fifth, so you can only find it in those stores. So in LA and the surrounding areas, there are locations at Beverly Connection, Costa Mesa, Cerritos, I believe Woodland Hills. But check the Saks Off Fifth website to confirm those locations.
Now, both of them are successful. They could have done any kind of line. Did they consider doing something maybe higher price, going like $500, $1,000? I mean, if something has Amy Schumer's name attached to it, I'm sure people would spend $1,000.
You know, that's a great question. But Evan said it was actually not even a consideration. They were, in fact, really trying to get the prices down as much as they could. Here's Evans.
We wanted it to be something that was for every woman. We wanted the clothes to be for everyone.
Now, I also read that there's a philanthropic component to this collection as well. Tell us about that.
Well, 30% of the net proceeds from sales of this collection will be donated to Community Partners, which is a not-for-profit organization that is in support of the Style Fund Project. And that's the duo's program that aims to empower women from all economic backgrounds to use clothing to increase their confidence and their success. I actually suggested, though, to Evans that she needs to mention to Amy that I think it should really be a program where they aim to give every person a stylist by the year 2030.
That would be
incredible,
don't you think? I need one because it's just t-shirt and jeans.
I think it should be a one-to-one stylist program.
That would be awesome. You know, we earlier talked about size inclusive and kind of joking about it at the start, but you know, you've been writing about fashion for a long time. The attention to sizing is something that in the last few years, designers, I mean, even from the highest rent designers to the lowest level, are really paying attention to how people feel about sizes and what that means to their self-confidence, to a lot of how you feel about yourself, self-esteem.
I think the operative word that you use is feel. And I think that's why there's actually been a movement away from using the term plus size. And we're going to see a lot more of size inclusive. And I think that's the point, is people really want to feel good about it. They don't want to feel that they are having something that is that they're an exception to the rule. They want to feel included.
Yeah, in numbers and things that, you know, large, extra large. It seems like nothing, right? But when someone does have issues with their weight or how they look in the mirror when they have to wear something that says extra large, it kind of adds another level and layer of like, ugh, you know.
It does. And actually, Evans and I talked about tips when women are shopping and men. It includes both. And one of the things she said is that the real key is about proportion and understanding yourself. So it's not really about the size. But once you start to develop what proportions of clothing look good on you and what works for you, then it's no longer about that. And that's something that she and Amy really worked at together, is helping her to feel comfortable with the proportions and with what she's wearing, because you can be comfortable and look stylish.
My clothing line would be called Smedium. That would be mine. Michelle Dalton Tyree of Fashion Trends Daily. We've been speaking about the new size including clothesline, La Cloud, founded by comedian Amy Schumer and her stylist Lisa Evans. So Michelle, thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks so much, eh?
All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow morning at 9. Air Talk with Larry Mantle is next. Hey, Larry.
Hi, A. What is a progressive? What does the term mean these days? Who's entitled to use it? We'll get into that with our political experts coming up in our second hour of Air Talk.
There's a wide range, right? Because you can either keep going left or keep going right, even within the progressive description.
Yeah, and how does it compare to being liberal? We'll talk about the terms and how they're used.
All right, that's Air Talk with Larry Mantle coming up at 10. Thanks, Larry.
Thanks, A.